From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Benji. Good afternoon, good evening, good night, good morning, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show. As the time here is just approaching 3 minutes past five, we're live on the usual channels. Thanks for joining me. I've got a brilliant guest lined up for you a little bit later on in the programme. Before that, though, I've got a news roundup. Well, unlike any other anywhere else in the world, he says.
Well, bring out the gimp.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, Tony Heller is a very, very interesting man with a very broad and successful career in science, in education and in engineering. And he runs a website called realclimatescience.com. That's realclimatescience.com. It's got a huge following on Twitter and on YouTube. And he takes on the theory that man-made climate change, well, is going to end the world as we know it in the very near future. He's in Colorado and Tony joins the program. I've been trying to get him on for some time, so I'm happy that he's agreed to come on today. Before that, as I said, news roundup, lots to talk about. I promise you that there will not be too much election stuff. There's some very interesting human interest stories in the news today that we want to get into on your Richie Allen Show. On the usual channels, we're on Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester, richieallen.co.uk. Trigger warning, tune in radio, and all the rest of it. Yeah, hope you had a good weekend. You're refreshed, are you? I work the weekends, Richie. All right. So do I. Get over yourself. Yeah. I do look forward to reading your tweets, by the way. Abby Jesus. Let's get into it then. The election is on Thursday. And there won't be too much election stuff in this particular show. I do hope, beyond hope, all my fingers and toes are crossed, that Jeremy Corbyn gets in. I hope that Jeremy Corbyn wins the election and forms a majority government this particular election.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yeah, I've not turned into a raging, screaming hypocrite. Don't worry about it. Don't matter a damn. Do you know why I hope he gets in? Because I can then say 6 months down the line, I told you so. And there's nothing remotely childish about that. I know it sounds it. Sounds a bit childish, a bit immature, a bit beneath me. But I can't wait, because it's the only way that some of you will learn. All right? All right. Does that mean I'm going to go and vote for Rebecca Long-Bailey? No. There's no point. She's a shoo-in. Doesn't matter. Right. Okay. I'll vote for Jesse Jackson. Right, here we go. John Kitson, by the way, who was on this programme. John, 5G awareness, John. You know all about John. He's standing in Totnes. And he has reported that the Green Party there in Totnes, in Devon, organised the hustings and they invited all candidates, but they didn't make room for John Kitson. Now, that's proper fuckery. That's nice, eh? Democracy in action. Imagine the Green Party, the friends of the environment, the lovers of the planet, want to bar a man because he might succinctly and he might lucidly talk about the information we have that 5G technology is a human health hazard. So that's the Greens for you. That's the Greens. Going to start off with a bit of humour today. Sky News this morning. 3 days of coverage left. Why 3 hours? Well, they're not allowed to report on the election on Thursday. All they can do on Thursday is show you images of people going to vote. But they can't report on it. They can't talk about the issues. That's the way it goes, right? On Thursday. In Ireland, we have a different rule. We have a moratorium the day before the election in Ireland. You know why? Because we're better than the English. We're better than the Brits. And you know it too. Yeah. Big tough guy there in Salford, all by yourself. I know. Yeah, we have the moratorium the day before, you see. Strangely, the Brits have it on the 3rd. I'm feeling very Republican today. The Brits. Oh, it's the Brits. Right, Sky News. Sky News this morning. Wait for it. I mean, this is pure vaudeville. My great friend, the beloved Jean Ann Crowley, will love that. Vaudeville. This is pure vaudeville. It really is, right? Labour's Richard Bergen is the Shadow Justice Secretary, Labour Party. Now, he was on Sky Breakfast this morning to discuss a major new announcement on spending by his pal, John McDonnell. Right? So it's a big deal. It's a big deal because it's Monday and the election looms Thursday. Big deal. And I swear to sunny Jesus and Mary and Holy Saint Joseph, he was about 15 seconds into his first answer when he is interrupted by the Sky presenter. Ready for some fuckery? Here we go.
As part of tackling climate change. And the third aspect that John McDonnell will be talking about today is starting off Labour's public ownership programme, ending the rip-off, bringing rail, mail and water back into public ownership, because this rip-off's gone on for far too long and consumers actually and members of the public have just suffered.
Okay, look, I'm very sorry to do this. If you can just stay with us for a moment, just need to have a look at this news conference.
This better be good, right?
News conference.
I mean, it's the opposition party, 3 days before the election, talking about a major new spending announcement. What's he interrupted him for?
In New Zealand.
Evening, everyone.
A fucking volcano!
Everyone, thank you for being here so late. Appreciate you all coming in so that we can give you an update on White Island.
Remember, this is 52,000 miles away in New Zealand.
I thought it was important that we spoke to our communities about what's occurred at White Island.
Yeah, the local communities.
So unfortunately, I can confirm there are five people now deceased from the eruption on White Island.
What kind of fuckery are you?
I don't give a shit if a T-Rex came up out of that volcano and was chasing a Triceratops. This is pure vaudeville, this. A volcanic eruption, yes, some people died, not good. Not nice. I'm not saying it isn't of any interest. But newsworthy, in the week of an election, newsworthy, do we stop the Shadow Justice Secretary talking about a big announcement and spending by the Shadow Chancellor to go to a press conference in New Zealand where a volcano erupted and some tourists were trapped or caught around it? Do we? You give it a mention once an hour, you link up with a local reporter. You don't give blanket coverage of it. And you don't blanket cover the press conferences because it's not relevant to a UK watching audience. Do you understand? Madness, isn't it? You should have seen the puss on Bergen. And when he came back, the presenter, Stephen Dixon, said, "Sorry about that, Richard. I'm sure you'll understand." I know I fucking don't understand. We've got an election on Thursday. Dipstick. Couldn't care less about a volcano. And to be fair to Bergen, I was about to throw the telly out the window if the Labour Party guy had said, "My thoughts and prayers are with the families in New Zealand." Very difficult for me to watch this stuff. Twitter, new terms of service. YouTube, Google, new terms of service. Twitter's new terms will allow the platform to shadow ban users. This is official now. We've been talking about it for a long time. Official. These new rules take effect in January. Okay. They've tweaked their terms of service to say that, this is Twitter talking now. I know Twitter doesn't talk. This is one of Twitter's people. "We may also remove or refuse to distribute any content on the services." Wait for it. "Limit distribution or visibility of any content on the service." That's the line right there. "Limit distribution or visibility of any content on the service." "We can suspend or terminate users and reclaim usernames without liability to you." Of course, this happening at the same time that YouTube is changing its terms of service to declare that Google YouTube reserves the right to remove non-commercially viable channels. Where's Amy when you need her? What kind of fuckery, eh, Amy? Yes, Google is saying we can take channels down that are not commercially viable. Yet it is Google and YouTube that is listing channels as not being suitable for advertising themselves. There's a bit of a paradox there. Yes, we can take down channels that are not commercially viable, particularly the ones that we won't place ads on. I did an interview with Jason Burmes today, top man Jason. It's on his YouTube channel. He did 24 videos in 24 hours today to mark Google YouTube's declaration that they can remove non-commercially viable channels. This is how it was always going to be. They corralled everybody, didn't they? I've used the term kettling to describe what's happened to us, dear listener. We've been kettled, haven't we? On Google, on Twitter, on Facebook and on Instagram, the only games in town, and we're all there now. We're all present and correct. They can see what we see. They can dictate what we see and prevent us seeing from what they don't want us to see, if you get my drift. 14 minutes past the hour. Boris Johnson was on the campaign trail today. Just a little bit of election news. Bojo. And I talked on the live stream tomorrow, which won't sound as bad, by the way, this YouTube live stream, which has had problems in recent days. It'll be better tomorrow. I talked about a Daily Mirror article about a very young boy who's very ill with pneumonia, but he was confined on a hospital corridor because there were no beds, with tubes sticking out of him. Boris Johnson was in Leeds, and I swear to God, and you can see this, there's a clip of this on social media today. He was asked about the young boy being on a trolley in a corridor and not in a bed by a reporter, female reporter. She showed him a picture of the boy on her phone, and incredibly, Johnson took the phone from the reporter and put it in his pocket. I kid you not. Here's BBC's Alex Forsyth. She was there. She saw it. What happened, Alex?
Earlier on this morning, Boris Johnson was asked to look at a photograph of a four-year-old boy, Jack Willamant Barr, who was photographed on the floor of Leeds General Infirmary earlier this month, where he had been attending A&E, and apparently there were not enough beds available. Now, an ITV reporter showed this image to Boris Johnson this morning, and initially the Prime Minister didn't look at that, and then he took the reporter's phone. Now, we're told by sources close to the Prime Minister that, in fact, he was offered the phone, but this has got a lot of traction on Twitter. This clip has been picked up and played out on social media and already condemned by some members of the Labour Party. And you have to bear in mind that this is a Prime Minister who is trying to win round people that perhaps have never voted for his party before on the basis of trust and on the basis of relatability.
He should have been arrested, the scruffy fecker. He should have been arrested. He took a phone. She was showing him the phone, right? Holding it so he could see it. He took it and put it in his pocket. Anyway, and as for relatability, who can possibly relate to Boris Johnson? You know what I mean? Anyway, while he was in Leeds, Boris hinted, he's lying, mind, he's lying, but he hinted that his government, if he's elected, would look at the BBC television licence. Here's Johnson again on the TV licence.
That the BBC should cough up and pay for the licences for the over 75s, as they promised to do. But at this stage, we are not planning to get rid of all TV licence fees, though I'm certainly looking at it. And what I will say is that I'm under pressure not to extemporise policy on the hoof. But you have to ask yourself whether that kind of approach to funding a TV, a media organisation, still makes sense in the long term, given the way other organisations manage to fund themselves. That's all I will say. I think the system of funding out of what is effectively a general tax, isn't it? Everybody has a TV. It bears reflection. Let me put it that way. How long can you justify a system whereby everybody who has a TV has to pay to fund a particular set of TV and radio channels? That is the question.
Yes, but don't believe him. Don't believe him for a minute. The Conservative Party is not going to go after the BBC television licence. Do not believe him. I mean, of course, it is preposterous to be forced to pay for the running of a TV station. You know, it still drives... I don't pay for it, of course. I don't use it. Don't use the service. Not interested in it. Nobody's going to force me to pay for it. To pay for the propaganda the state is targeting me and mine with. I'm not going to pay for your propaganda. All right? I don't buy it, not for a minute. Thanks for your tweets. Keep them coming in, by the way. Good to be with you this Monday. Faisal tweets, Google should never have been allowed to take YouTube over. That was the end of any illusion of free speech. Yes, I have been saying that for 10 years. 10 years! And I said it to Jason Burmes on his radio show today. 10 years, Faisal, you're spot on. Absolutely right. Google bought YouTube, and then Google, as the biggest search engine in the world, was able to marginalise MySpace and other video platforms. It breached every decent anti-competition law that ever existed. It's disgusting. But of course it goes far deeper than most people understand. This is the way it's meant to be. You know, where this all ends, where it is supposed to end, is with the total decimation of freedom of speech and freedom of thought. But also, of course, freedom of choice. Your freedom to say, I want to listen to the Big Baldy Gammon in Salford. Or your freedom to say, I think the Big Baldy Gammon is fucking useless. I don't want to listen to him, but he should be allowed to broadcast as he sees fit. Those are the only choices. Love the Big Baldy Gammon, like the Big Baldy Gammon, think he's okay sometimes, or he's useless. But that's freedom of choice. And that's what they want to take away from every one of us. Said this to Jason today. They're coming for us. This isn't Alex Jones-esque fear fucking porn. We don't do that here. They're coming for us. For the independent media. Particularly for people like me to do 5-6 live radio shows a week. They don't want us broadcasting. They don't want me talking to you. They don't want our phone-ins where people can phone in and chat about things. And give us information like the information we were given about what's going on in Oldham over there with grooming gangs. They don't want that. This is what's happening, you see. Almost beautiful in its malevolence. Oxymoronic language is the thing today, isn't it? 20 minutes it is past the hour. I'll leave that there because I've opined too often on that. You know what's going on. I don't need to tell you. Come on, let's have a giggle. Did you see this in the Star? Front page mentioned it this morning. The woke, or Generation Z, apparently want TV shows that aired before 2015 to be airbrushed so much that they are no longer funny or even easy to understand. Even Friends, Joey and Monica and Chandler and Ross and who else is in it? Phoebe? Anybody I forgot? No. No? Yeah. Friends is racist and homophobic, as we've learned recently. Well, Fawlty Towers is back on UK television through a Netflix-controlled channel, a new channel. It's also on UK Gold. It's on Netflix, as I said, and progressives are up in arms. If you've never heard of Fawlty Towers, it was a very late 70s BBC situation comedy. It ran only for 2 seasons, which was genius. Because every single episode is hilarious. It's about a lunatic who, with his wife, runs a hotel in Torquay called Basil Fawlty. And Basil is kind of schizophrenic. He's kind of very uptight, very unhappy man, but very funny. They've got a Spanish waiter who barely speaks English and an American waitress who basically keeps the whole thing together. It's a brilliant thing. And progressives are up in arms over one particular scene in one particular episode. Shall we play it? Shall we? Go on. It's Fawlty, the manager, Basil, and longtime resident Major, the Major, who is approaching 80. Now, this was filmed in the 1970s, and the character, the Major, is nearly 80 then. And they are talking about women. And this is apparently very offensive.
Strange creatures, women.
Well, can't stand around all
day. I knew one once. Nice-looking girl, tall, you know. Father was a banker.
Really?
Don't remember the name of the bank.
Well, never mind.
I must have been keen on her because I took her to see India.
India?
At the Oval. Fine match. A marvellous finish. Now, Sally had to get 33 in about a half an hour, and she went off to her pal, Butter hands or something, women never came back.
What a shame.
And the strange thing was that throughout the morning she kept referring to the Indians as niggers. No, I said. Niggers are the West Indians. These people are wogs. No, she said, all cricketers are niggers.
They do get awfully confused, don't they? They're not thinkers. I see it with Sybil every day.
I do wish I could remember her name.
The Major and Faulty. Brilliant stuff. Rory Bremner, to his credit, said today that it's quite obvious that John Cleese was ridiculing colonial attitudes in the script. Obviously. And Connie Booth, who wrote the whole thing with him, they're laughing at these colonial attitudes and the old-fashioned kind of old cavalier, old army attitude of the Major. They're laughing at the Major's expense, said Rory Bremner. They're not laughing at the races mentioned, the West Indians or the Indians. And in fact, the audience reaction is very telling. So we say to Generation Woke, which are as far from being awake as I am from planet Pluto, don't ban it, you miserable pussies. You can't erase your history, good, bad or indifferent. You're stuck with it. Debate it, talk about it. Jesus Christ. 24 minutes past the hour. It's time for the Rolling Stones and Mick Jagger, I think. Yeah. This is the Richie Allen Show for Monday. It is 9th of December 2019. This is Jumpin' Jack Flash on your Richie Allen Show. Coming back with more comments. Don't forget, brilliant guests later.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Now you're very welcome back. Gail remembers Fatty Owls with some fondness. I better explain, Gail. There was a sign outside Faulty Towers that said Faulty Towers. But in such a dilapidated state was the hotel that often some of the letters would be missing or rearranged, you see. Very good, Gail, very good. Hi to Susan, who says, soon we will be like the Enid. No past, no history, fleeting present and no future. Just fodder for the elite's vegetable patch, says Susan. Jesus, Susan. That's a bleak outlook, but I hear you. I hear you. Patrick says, banning classic comedy like Faulty Towers just because a few commonplace, at the time, racist innuendos were voiced is a heinous act far exceeding in severity than any minutely offensive language that most people of the races involved would laugh at then and now. Jesus Christ, Patrick, regurgitate that dictionary you swallowed, man. You've lost the common touch. How you doing, Patrick? Are you well? Nice to hear from you today. Christ almighty, some of these tweets, huh? Huh? Hi to David, who says, the cost of putting CGI makeup and a skirt on Joey and a moustache on Phoebe in every frame would be astronomical. Yeah. I love it. Hi to John Byrne, how you doing, John? Right. Oh yes, on the John Kitson not being invited to the Green Party hustings, even though the other candidates were invited. John Byrne says, the organiser said John was a climate change denier and a Holocaust denier. The organiser is obviously a member of one or two cults, says John. John Kitson hasn't denied the Holocaust, has he? Not to my knowledge. I mean, I've never... There wouldn't be any reason for us to be discussing the Holocaust, John Kitson and I, because he's come on to talk about 5G. But that's a bit outrageous if that's the truth. He should sue. He should sue. The Green Party will have money if somebody called him a Holocaust denier. And there is evidence of it. If there's audio or video, he should sue. 29 minutes to the top of the hour. Don't forget, a little bit later on in the programme, Tony Heller joins me. Really interesting about climate change. You don't want to miss that. So Donald Trump, the US president, has been accused of anti-Semitism. Can you believe it? Why? Well, he told a pro-Israel Jewish group that they will vote for him in order to protect their wealth. Trump referred to members of the Israeli-American Council as brutal killers and not nice people. He didn't really, did he? Well, he did. Do you want to hear it? Ah, you do. Here's Trump. Brutal killers. He's speaking to Jewish folks who are members of the Israeli-American Council. Here you go.
A lot of you are in the real estate business because I know you very well. You're brutal killers. Not nice people at all, but you have to vote for them. You have no choice. You're not going to vote for Pocahontas, I can tell you that.
And by Pocahontas, he means Elizabeth Warren, apparently.
You're not going to vote for the wealth tax.
Yeah. The stereotypes about Jews.
Yeah, let's take 100% of your wealth away. No, no. Even if you don't like me, some of you don't. Some of you I don't like at all, actually. And you're going to be my biggest supporters because you'll be out of business in about 15 minutes if they get it.
You money-hungry, money-hoarding Jews, you. You'll vote for me to avoid the wealth tax, said Donald. Seriously, Jewish leaders, whoever they are, according to the Independent newspaper today, are raging in the United States at what they deem to be blatant anti-Semitism by the Donald. Well, of course, the Jews are not brutal killers. Of course, they're not. But the illegitimate state of Israel is. Maybe Donald had a few wires crossed there, maybe. You know. Anyway, Trump is also worried that American Jews, and Americans as well, just ordinary Americans, they don't love Israel enough, said Donald.
We have to get the people of our country, of this country, to love Israel more. I have to tell you that. We have to do it. We have to get them to love Israel more. Because you have people that are Jewish people, that are great people, they don't love Israel enough. You know that. You know that.
I think we need to get every Jew in America to go to one of these fairgrounds where you get one of these big mallets and you hold the mallet over your head and you hit the bell and see how far it goes up the tower. See how much you love Israel. Jews don't love Israel enough. Americans don't love Israel enough, said the Donald, as he was virtue signalling to his captive audience there on Saturday. Just in case the Zionist lunatics, the scumbags, there aren't many of them in the UK, but there are a few of them. Just in case you didn't hear what I said, Jews are not brutal killers, of course, at least no Jews that I know, but the illegitimate, apartheid, Nazi state of Israel is. Did you hear that? You did. Good, good. Make sure you're listening. Staying with the United States, Trump's defense secretary is a guy called Mark Esper. Now, he was on Fox News last night. And because Trump told the Israeli-American Council a lot of horror stories about Iran, you should have heard it. I could play quite a few clips from Donald's address to the Israeli-American Council. A lot of horror stories about the Iranians. So to double down on it, Fox News, that doyen of impartial journalism, invited Mark Esper, the US Defense Secretary, on. And the first person you'll hear is the presenter, a guy called Chris Wallace. Then you'll hear Mark Esper. It's good stuff, this.
There are reports that the Pentagon is working on a plan, considering a plan to send 7,000 more US troops to the Middle East. I understand the president has not decided on this yet, but what would more U.S. troops help us do to counter the threat from Iran?
Well, first of all, I have no plans right now or orders to send 7,000 or 14,000 additional troops to the Middle East. But what I've said consistently, certainly to Congress and to others, that is that on a weekly basis, daily basis, we monitor what's happening in the Persian Gulf. We watch what Iran is doing to make sure we understand what their intentions are. What I'm trying to do in that theater are a few things. Number one, reassure our allies, such as the Saudis and the UAE and other countries in the region. Number two,
I go on, say Israel.
Number two, affirm the right of countries for freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas. And number three, hold up the international rules-based order. So what I'm trying to do from the Defense Department is deter Iranian bad behavior. If you recall, several months ago, they were going after ships in the Strait of Hormuz. They shot down one of our drones.
Well, they did shoot down one of your drones. We know that. But there's no evidence that they attacked any ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Maybe that's why you didn't mention Israel.
We've reached a point, I think, that we've deterred further Iranian bad behavior. But as we see Iranian behavior or intentions changing, I will change our force posture to maintain that deterrence.
Our force posture, he said. Any chance the Fox News guy, whose name is... They're so alike, these Fox News idiots. What's the guy's name again? What is his name? Chris Wallace. Any chance that Chris Wallace will say, but come on, Iran? Iran hasn't attacked anyone since Moses was in short trousers. Since Jesus was a dirty thought in his father's mind. The Iranians haven't attacked anybody. Any chance the Fox News guy will say that? Nah.
You say that there are certain things they aren't doing. They aren't going after ships in the Persian Gulf. They aren't shooting down drones. We sent in, you sent in 14,000 more troops since May.
Since May.
But the Iranians are continue to ship missiles around the area to Iraq, to Yemen. They have recently tested a new missile that apparently would have the ability to deliver a nuclear weapon.
It's hard to tell who the U.S. Defense Secretary is. And who the Fox News presenter is, isn't it? Listen to the guy go on and on and on. This is the presenter.
The Iranians are continue to ship missiles around the air.
Fucking bastard Iranians.
Yeah, to Iraq. To
missiles, everybody. This is actually the presenter, not the defense secretary, who seems moderate by comparison.
To Yemen, they have recently tested a new missile that apparently would have the ability to deliver a nuclear weapon. What would more...
Just making it up as he goes along.
What would more troops do? Could they deter that action? And are you basically saying we're prepared to get into a shooting war with Iran?
Well, what I...
No questions at all about the threat. Rather than ask about the threat, because you see, as a presenter, it's your job to hold them to account. You must go into any interview that you do with a defense minister. You must be a hostile presenter. You have to be. Because they are warmongering, mass-murdering fucking scumbags. That's all they do. Esper is just the latest spook. Defense Secretary Madman, who's shilling for, well, he's shilling for what we call neocon Zionist interests. Right? Telling lies. And as the presenter, you're supposed to be very hostile to these guys. And he should be saying... any evidence at all? Because Iran hasn't ever really done anything ever to anybody, ever. Really. But he doesn't. He actually turns into maybe what Donald Trump would prefer his defense secretary to be. It's crazy, isn't it? This is your media in 2019.
Said publicly, is we are prepared to respond if, depending on what Iran does, and they need to understand that our restraint should not be interpreted as weakness. We are prepared to defend ourselves and our friends and allies if necessary.
Defend ourselves. Who's ever attacked the United States of America?
But you've hit on two important things. For 40 years now, since the revolution, Iran's been engaged in a number of activities that have done nothing but undermine the entire region. It's the malign behavior in any number of countries stretching from Africa.
If you listen to these neocon Zionist nutcases, you would imagine that Iran came into being in 1979. There was no history to Iran, according to these guys. It was just 1979, they overthrew the Shah. Yeah, but you overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. And Iran was a beautiful country. It was lovely. It was secular. It was marvellous. He'd renationalised the oil. Everybody was going to school. Everybody had money. And you went in and you destroyed the country. But no, Iran begins in 1979. That's what you've got to get into your heads.
To Afghanistan, their missile program, their nuclear program, hostage taking.
Hostage taking? Who?
Those are the things we want.
Oh yeah, Zaghawi, yeah.
Want. In a new and comprehensive agreement with them to get rid of. What we want is Iran to join and to become a normal nation, a normal country.
Good luck with that.
Well, we have to get rid of. What we want is Iran to join.
Listen to the presenter.
Become a normal nation, a normal country.
Good luck with that.
Well, we have to do it. I mean, it's like I said, they are their hands are in every type of country right. out there, stirring things up.
Their hands are in every country out there. Did he say that?
That.
Well, we have to do it. I mean, it's like I said, they are their hands are in every type of country right. out there, stirring things up. Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Yemen. I mean, we can go all across this region and talk about Iranian bad behavior.
Yeah, I'd like to do unspeakable things to him. And to everybody that associates with him, but of course you can't. You can only fantasize. 19 minutes to the top of the hour. Hi to Phil Restino in Florida. How you doing, Phil? Nice to know you're listening today. This is your Richie Allen Show, Monday's programme. Don't forget Tony Heller joining the programme a little bit later on. I've been chasing Tony for a bit of a while, so I'm delighted that Tony is coming on the programme later on. Now, let me read you this. Excuse me. This is important now. We'll straighten up a bit. Sexual violence against women is on the increase in the UK. That's what we were told today, and I think it's true. I've been looking into this for some time, going back a few years. And one of the things that's happening is that in murder cases, where women are murdered, in cases where women claim that they were forced into sex without their consent, something new is happening, and it's happening more and more and more. Men are using what's called a rough sex defence, and it's become more and more and more common. And today we heard a lot about Millane. She was nearly 22. I think the day before she turned 22, was backpacking in New Zealand, went out with a guy she met on Tinder, went back to his place, and he strangled her to death during sex. Now, he was found guilty, but there was outrage expressed right across the media, not just by feminist groups, but not just by women's groups, but by legal minds, lawyers, academics. They were outraged at the rough sex defence implied by the murder of Grace Millane. Now, in this country, in the last 10 years, there's been a 90% increase in the rough sex defence. And in the last 5 years, it's been successful in almost half the cases that it has been used in. Now, Fiona McKenzie is an activist, and she set up a group called We Can't Consent to This, which is campaigning to have the rough sex defence thrown out of British courts. Fiona McKenzie was on Sky News this afternoon with Hattie Brett, the editor of Grazia magazine. Listen to this. You'll hear Hattie Brett first, then you'll hear Fiona McKenzie. It's important stuff, this. We talked a lot about this in recent months and even on my programmes in the last few years.
Of course, they're expressing shock and sympathy for Grace Millane's family and friends, but also a number of women were coming forward to say that they, as sexually active single young women today, have experienced non-consensual choking during sex themselves. And you'll be aware of a recent BBC survey saying that a third of under 40-year-old women also say that they have experienced unwanted choking, gagging, hitting, spitting during sex. So it's clear that this is a real problem and that we're really seeing a normalisation of violence against women in sex. And we all need to tackle that with clear conversations about what boundaries in the bedroom mean. But when that is being used in court as an easy excuse for murder, and that defence, the rough sex defence, is being used to lesser sentences against men, we need Parliament to act and we need courts to recognise that women need protection.
It's interesting, Fiona, the Centre for Women's Justice said this is likely, the research you're citing there, Hattie, about women experiencing unwanted slapping, choking, etc. The Centre for Women's Justice, Fiona, said this is likely to be due to the widespread availability, normalisation and use of extreme pornography.
Yeah, it's sort of grim. And again, when I set up this campaign last year, I immediately started hearing from women who had been strangled, sometimes into unconsciousness, by men that they were dating. So you meet a man on Tinder, you get on with him, and then, you know, you find yourself the subject of a horrible, violent assault. Something terrible has gone wrong. So it sounds like it seems to us that men are being coached into doing violence against women. And we've heard that from men who use porn, that choking is particularly common in porn now. And also there is something that in just kind of culture, like social media, and I have to say some women's magazines have been really pushing the idea that that strangulation or choking of women is this kind of thing you want to do as a beginner's thing to try with your partner. That's really scary, and we really, as Hattie says, we're so excited that Grazia is helping us push back on that.
Yeah, we've talked a lot on this programme about the death of intimacy, the death of, I don't know, joy, just pure joy, sexual joy, emotional joy in being naked with a member of the opposite sex that you happen to love. It is insane, this. We're being attacked, aren't we, as humans? The humanity has been trained out of us in so many different ways. This is a big problem. In fact, I was listening to one of the BBC mid-morning programmes recently on radio. It might have been even TV. It might have been Victoria Derbyshire. And there were a number of mothers on there talking about discovering their preteen sons, discovering them, discovering or learning that they'd been watching this type of porn pretty much constantly. And one of the mothers made the point, which I've made myself more than once. She said, well, this is the only porn, really. There isn't any other porn now, absent violent, aggressive, rotten pornography, where a woman has been hammered by several men, and as the description there, spat on, gagged, kicked, slapped. That's what you get. You go to any of the big porn providers now, they're all free. And that's what you'll see on the homepage. What they call hardcore sex. Disgusting, rotten sex. How anybody could be turned on by it, I have no idea. But it's all that young lads are seeing when they go online. And we know, through a number of brilliant studies done by Japanese neuroscientists or neurologists, it has a profound impact on the development of the child's brain watching that. And under MRI scan, you can see the changes physiologically happening to the child from watching that nonsense. So is it any wonder then you got lads now leaving school or even in school, going into college, and their sexual fantasies are fueled by violence? Crazy times these. What do you do about that? I've no idea. I'd be terrified. I'm not joking when I say this. We'd love to have a child. We make no secret of this, you know. We're private people, but we get asked so often. I get asked all the time about children, even though I am very private and I keep my private life very private. You know, I'm honest, love to have a child. How could you bring a child? What would you be doing now with a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old child? How do you keep them away from that? Madness, huh? Madness. We are at 12 minutes to the top of the hour. It's fairly depressing, that. Listen, we talked this morning on the live stream about an incident, an alleged incident of racism. I won't go into a rant. Don't worry. A man has been arrested, and I'm not sure if he's been released from custody yet. He should be. He shouldn't be remanded, unless he's being remanded for his own safety. But it has been claimed that he made a monkey gesture to a couple of Manchester United footballers, a couple of black players, Fred and Jesse Lingard. I'm a big Manchester United fan, big part of my life, and I watched the game. That's why I'm saying that, because I watched the game. I don't take offence on behalf of Fred or Jesse Lingard. Anyway, this guy says he was putting his hands in his pocket and he didn't make monkey gestures. But he has been tried, convicted and sentenced on social media, to the point where his ex-girlfriend and some of his family are receiving death threats. If he was making monkey gestures, well, he's an insufferable arsehole, isn't he? To be referring to a person like that. What an idiot, right? And I won't repeat what I said this morning about, you know, judge and jury and Twitter. But I was interested to listen to Radio 5 Live this morning, and I heard a guy called Sanjay Bhandari. Sanjay is the top man at Kick It Out, which is an anti-racism organisation. And you can probably guess, Kick It Out means it's a football-based anti-racist organisation. And he was on Radio 5 Live with Nicky Campbell. And I've got a couple of clips for you, because a couple of interesting things came out of those interviews. All right. Don't be triggered. If you happen to be black, don't be triggered. I'm not making any excuses for the guy. If the guy did it, and meant it, if he meant to call those lads monkeys, well, he's a proper Muppet. And I said what I would do is he would lose his season ticket forever, but he would get a 2-year ban from the ground, 1 year suspended. So halfway through next season, if he wants to apply for tickets like everybody else, he can apply for tickets. Nobody deserves to be deemed to be finished, that their life's over, that they are irredeemable because they make a mistake, no matter how bad you might think it is. He's not killed anybody. He's not raped a child. He's not murdered anyone. You know, he's not stabbed anyone. He's not stolen from an old lady that he was minding. He's just a plonker if he is a plonker. People are entitled to a second chance, right? Is forgiveness gone now? Is that what we're seeing with social media? Is social media creating the pathway to a future where there's no forgiveness for anything? If it is deemed by the Twitterati, by the elders of Twitterati, if you have been deemed to have infringed upon the rules laid down by these people, that you are finished forever. I think it is, and I think there's a good reason for it. It's to warn people off. It's to bring in a new era of self-censorship. There won't be any need for censorship in the future. Anyway, look, these two guys, Sanjay Bhandari from Kick It Out and Nikki Campbell, were talking about this morning.
We have to be very careful about our rhetoric, about how we how we phrase things.
And that's exactly what they want. You hear Nikki Campbell there? You did. This is a Radio 5 presenter.
We have to be very careful about our rhetoric, about how we phrase things.
That's the desired result. That's the societal desired result. That's where they want us in the near future. Everybody. I said to Jean Ann one morning, I think Jean Ann got a giggle out of it. Conversations are going to take fucking 2 hours in the future. Ordinary conversations in public are going to take 2 hours. Because before you say anything, you're going to spend 5 minutes thinking about it and thinking about the consequences. And you might only be talking about popping around the boozer or popping into town to see a concert. Going to a football match. Everything will be, hang on, can I say that? How should I phrase this? Could somebody be offended by the way I choose my words here? That's the way we're going to be. Anyway, Sanjay.
And some people's minds apply to, you know, Mr. Neville as well. But your point is well made. People are retreating into their own racist identity and indeed religious silos, aren't they? And it's all about the in-group and the out-group. And that seems to be getting worse and worse and worse in the world. You mentioned President Trump. How does he come into it?
Well, I think he's a symptom of exactly the...
What the fuck does President Trump have to do with it?
Exactly the same sort of factors and conditions that we're really just talking about, which is the move towards the extremes of politics, which in order to appeal to a particular identity group, you see someone like Trump really just wanting to appeal to his base, not really looking to engage with the other side, not even once he's in power. And that's a general
In this country, you have both the main political parties having problems with racism and many people in them being accused of having racist attitudes. So to follow your argument, it's pretty close to home as well in the polity, in the political class.
Absolutely, and it's both sides. So I'm trying to be apolitical. I have no particular affiliation to either party, and there are challenges on either side. I think trying to make a sort of neutral assessment that it's about the identity politics and the movements towards you're either in my group or you're not in my group, and I'm not going to engage with your ideas. I'm just going to engage with your identity, and I'm going to discount your views because your identity is different to mine.
So was it?
He's nearly there, isn't he, Sanjay Bhandari? He's so close. I mean, he's neatly there described what identity politics is and what it does. But where these guys never go is just one or two steps into the beyond. Maybe, Sanjay, maybe there's something very powerful working to induce, to bring in, to herald in, to change things the way you've just described, to make us think and act the way you just described, maybe. But they never get it, do they? They just get the outside edges of it.
So was was it better in the past when racism was worse on the terraces, as we might term them?
Well, I think...
I don't understand the correlation there, because racism in football amongst the fans, it's terrible, it's disgusting, but is it not a lot better than it was in the past?
I'd love to be like Nicky Campbell. I'd love to be pure of heart, godlike almost, in my virtue. I'd love to be as nice as Nicky Campbell. That's why Nicky Campbell has never been a successful radio presenter. I don't give a shit what he gets paid by the BBC. He's never done anything. They leave him on Radio 5 Live because it's got one of its lowest audience shares of the morning market. He's utterly worthless. No idea does Campbell. No idea that if you're real, you know, if you're a real person and connect with your audience and stop this virtue signalling. We've all made mistakes. We've all done bad things. We've all said bad things. I'm sure during the course of my adult life, I'm sure that I have said things that others could say, well, that's a bigoted thing to say. That's a prejudiced thing to say. Or that's even a racist thing to say. Who would believe me otherwise if I said I didn't? Nobody. Holier than thou, BBC arseholes, eh?
Exactly. Racism a lot better than it was over a 30-year period.
Yes.
But this rise in identity politics has been over the last 3, 4, 5 years. That's
yeah. Right. Well, then it is identity politics. It isn't racism. That's what he doesn't get. It is identity politics. It isn't racism. It's a race to the bottom is what it is. But it's not racism.
It's the thing that I think has partly contributed
I understand.
To what we've seen over the last 3 years.
But this is
and
one idiot.
That we didn't have 40 years ago.
And we see a lot of this in Eastern Europe, and we've seen some terrible incidents recently. But I saw a lot of people online, you know, decent people, saying, okay, let's not get out of control here. This is one cretinous individual doing one thing. Let's keep some perspective. What do you say to those people?
It's both right and wrong. It's right that this is one cretinous individual doing something and we should not get it out of kilter. But by the same token, we're also seeing that correlation in the increase in hate crime over the last 3 years. And I think the Home Office statistics that were released earlier in the summer demonstrated that. So there is something going on.
Hate crime is a nonsense, of course. There's either a crime or there isn't. Hate crime has got nothing to do with it. It's dreadful. They then moved on briefly to talk about homophobic crimes. Because apparently at a football match over the weekend, somebody was arrested for homophobic chanting, apparently, at a football match.
There must be gay or bisexual players. It probably says something about the culture of football.
No, there must be gay and bisexual players in football, but maybe these guys are private and they don't want to be talking about their personal lives in public, maybe. Maybe they don't feel the need to, maybe.
It's the culture of football that we need to... That we need to focus on. In terms of the...
Wait till you hear how ridiculous this gets now.
So that someone feels comfortable being themselves. In terms of the specific chanting, actually one of our challenges there is getting a broader acceptance that particular chant is homophobic. Some people, there is still...
Which particular chant do we need to accept is homophobic? There is a chant out there and there isn't a consensus yet on whether it is homophobic or not.
Some people are still debating that, and so that's something that we're having.
What is it?
Having conversations with a couple of other organisations.
What was the chant?
As to how we. So there's a common chant about Chelsea and Rent Boys. That's the chant. What kind of fuckery are
you? Yeah, I knew the chant, of course, because I've been going to football matches my entire life. Sometimes when we play Chelsea, some of our fans sing, Chelsea, rent boys, Chelsea, rent boys. That's apparently homophobic, and when it is decreed to be thus, or as such, you will be arrested. Yes. You will be arrested for singing Chelsea, rent boys. What kind of fuckery are we? The fuckery we are is, we took Huxley and we took Orwell, we put him into a fucking mixer, we put it on full speed, we took what came out and we poured it into a mould. And we left the mould dry. We did that. We cooled it down in a fridge. And what came out was 2019. Chelsea Rent Boys. Chelsea Rent Boys. Is homophobic, apparently. This is your Richie Allen Show. The time is 6 o'clock, would you believe? It's 6 o'clock, would you believe? And it's time for some more music. When we come back from that, Tony Heller should be joining us live from Colorado in the US of A. I can't wait to hear from him. In the meantime, this is Cher. Music from Cher on the Richie Allen Show. It's coming up for 4 minutes past six. It's Monday, the 9th of December, 2019. If you're just joining the programme, welcome to it. I was fading my own microphone there like an Egypt. Yeah, the other one. The other fader. Yeah, welcome to the programme if you're just joining me. Let me just give you a quick promo for Trigger Warning TV on YouTube. Triggerwarning.tv, the website. Hayden Hewitt and Graham Booth, two guys I know very well, of course, in Manchester. They're putting together some terrific programmes and bulletins and news items on a daily basis, which the editorial of which is often very different to that which you hear on this programme. They're very good. Check them out. Very funny as well. So they are, the two lads. It's triggerwarning.tv. Right, I'm hoping Tony Heller is there. Chatted with him last night, and we swapped contact details. I've been trying to raise him in the last couple of minutes, and as of yet, I'm not sure he's there. But we'll give him plenty of time. Anyway, we've got plenty of time today. We've got plenty of time today. By the way, should we speak with Tony, and I hope we do, if there's anything you'd like me to mention to him, do tweet it to me. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. That's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Tony is there, which is good. Thank heavens for that. Be looking forward to speaking with him. Let's get him on and let's introduce him. Before we say hello to him, though, you will know that the COP25 has been taking place in Madrid. It's going on this week as well. It began last week. It's going on this week. And it's a very interesting thing to see the media coverage of it. Because, as I've mentioned to you more often than not, recently, I've mentioned it quite a bit recently, BBC News and Sky News and even Channel 4 News in the UK has an editorial policy now that the debate on climate change is settled. That's their policy. We know the BBC circulated a missive, for want of a better word, a brief to its editorial staff last year, telling them no need for balance anymore. If you're talking climate change, get the Greens on, get Friends of the Earth on, get the IPCC on, yeah, and that's good enough. Well, maybe it's not good enough. I want to introduce my guest this hour. I'm really happy he's on the programme today because I've been trying to get him on for a while. He's got a terrific website called realclimatescience.com. Do check it out if you haven't before. He's got a YouTube channel as well where he gets thousands and thousands of views because the science isn't settled. And I think there is a lot of appetite amongst people to find out what's really going on with global warming or climate change. He's a very experienced teacher, educator, second level, third level. He's a scientist, he's worked in the computer game industry, and he's used his scientific background and his critical thinking to analyse the claims made about man-made climate change. And as I said, it's gotten him a huge audience. He's in California, excuse me, he's in Colorado even. The website is realclimatescience.com. Let's welcome to the programme Mr. Tony Heller. Tony, thanks for coming on the programme. How are you?
I'm good, Richie.
You're a gentleman for doing it. Thanks so much. I've been trying to reach you for a while, but you're not an easy man to catch. And I think there's a good reason for that. I think you're bloody busy with your YouTube channel and your website, but thanks for doing it. Let me ask you, Tony, when you heard that the BBC, which of course is, okay, it's the UK, but it's a global name in journalism, when you heard that it was telling its staff, the debate is over, don't give any airtime anymore to those who question the science. What did you think of that as a scientist yourself?
Well, I've got a book right in front of me, Richie, from 1972. It was published by the BBC. And the title of the book is The Weather Machine and the Threat of Ice. In the 1970s, the BBC was pushing the idea that we're going to have a new catastrophic ice age.
Wow.
So this is nothing new for them. They've been doing this for a long time. And, you know, the whole idea of censoring, you know, of journalists or politicians picking science, you know, there's a terrible history of that. You know, the BBC loves to talk about the persecution of Galileo, when in fact they're behaving exactly the same way as what went on in the 16th century. So it's a terrible way for them to behave.
Do we, My listeners have asked me to put lots of different questions to you. I know you'll be bored by some of them. That's not to criticise my listeners, but I know you'll have heard many of these before. What about the 98% claim, Tony? This idea that academia around the world has come to a consensus that we are running out of time if we don't stop climate change. What about that 98% figure? Is it true?
Well, no, it's completely fake. There's no basis for it at all. I can guarantee you that 98% of the scientists in the world have never been asked in any kind of survey what their opinion is on climate change. You know, that number is a fabrication which was made up by the press and politicians. Barack Obama started pushing it in 2013, and it was based on a study which used just some really, really misleading and dodgy statistics. You know, I'm a geologist, and I've never met another geologist who believes in catastrophic climate change, not a single one. And there's lots of top scientists like Freeman Dyson, who's probably considered the greatest living physicist, who's a prominent climate skeptic. Harrison Schmitt, who's the only scientist to have walked on the moon, is a prominent climate skeptic. In fact, 49 of the top people from the Apollo program who actually went to the moon wrote a letter to the NASA administrator a few years ago asking him to please stop doing all this climate junk science, which is an embarrassment to the agency. So there's no basis to that number. It's strictly propaganda. And it's pretty disturbing that it keeps getting thrown around by politicians and the press.
You mentioned these gentlemen, and it's a tragedy. Many of them are, well, most of them are still with us, and yet you wouldn't know it because they're conspicuous by their absence, aren't they, Tony, when it comes to national television? You mentioned geology, and I was going to bring that up. That's your field. You'll, of course, know all about Ian Plimer, of course. You'll know more about him than I know, another very prominent, very smart man who lectured, I think, at Westminster some years ago and told the UK's Parliament that the whole notion of man-made CO2 causing climate change is nonsense. Tony, can you talk to us about geology in terms of talking about our relationship with CO2? Because we're told that CO2, this gas, we're producing too much of it. It's in the atmosphere. It's leading to weather changes around the world that are going to get more and more and more extreme. But I understand from reading your website, which is terrific, by the way, realclimatescience.com, I understand that you as a geologist can help us understand this in a pretty simplistic way. We sequester most of the CO2 that is produced anyway. It goes into the rocks and it goes into the oceans. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, well, you know, before the days of climate modelers taking over the term, geologists and paleontologists were the climate scientists because much of geology depends on an understanding of the past climates of the Earth. Like people who are exploring for oil, they tend to look for certain types of fossils which belong to certain depositional environments which belong to certain climates. And so geologists had to understand how past climates worked, and they had to understand the relationship to carbon dioxide, which is a critical part of a lot of geology. So we know there's never been any question that the greatest explosion of life on Earth occurred 540 million years ago during the Cambrian era, when corals and shellfish and all kinds of other sea creatures evolved. And that was right at the peak of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. CO2 levels were believed to have been 15 times higher at 540 million times years ago than they are now. And at that peak of carbon dioxide, life flourished and thrived. Life was doing extremely well. So you hear all this talk about ocean acidification, which is absurd, because we know that sea life did extremely well at much higher levels of CO2. And in fact, the current levels of CO2 are very close to the lowest they've ever been. Right now, we're at about 400 parts per million. If CO2 levels in the atmosphere dropped to 200 parts per million, plants would quit growing. And greenhouse, you know, typically indoors, you know, if you sit in a car for 20 minutes with, say, three other adults, carbon dioxide levels in the car will go up 15 times to about 6,000 parts per million. And inside a house, they're typically around 1,000 parts per million. So these people talking about these small increases in CO2 being toxic or dangerous, they have no basis in reality. And the idea that it threatens life or threatens the weather is also completely absurd. There's nothing in the geologic record or in our understanding of how plants grow which support that sort of idea.
They say, some of these people, it's difficult for me to be the devil's advocate today, Tony, because having read so much about this in recent years, like yourself, I didn't have any axe to grind with anybody. I must point out, by the way, Tony isn't paid by anybody. Often when people like Tony, academics like Tony, speak out about this issue, they're often accused of having ties to big oil and gas. I mean, if you had a pound or if you had a dollar, Tony, for every time you were accused of that, I don't think you'd be you wouldn't be sitting here right now. You'd be in the Bahamas on a cruise ship somewhere observing the beautiful Caribbean waters. But you're not connected to any industry. That's fair enough.
No, at this point, I've never received any sort of funding from any organization. I do get a decent amount of small donations from my blog, particularly the last few months.
That's good. It's nice that people are supporting an independent voice like yours. So then, and we've got till more or less till the top of the hour, with your permission. Fascinated then how an educator, how a scientist, how an academic, a geologist like yourself, when did you get into it, Tony? When did you say, wow, I've got to get involved here, the information is untrue? When did it start for you?
Well, I've always been interested in the weather. That was big part of my growing up. I had my own little weather station, and around then, I was working at Los Alamos Labs in the year in around 1980, and my boss introduced to me the idea of global warming, and it all seemed very believable. And from my experience, it appeared to be happening. I was working a lot in Bristol in the 1990s, in the late 1990s. And I'd fly into Heathrow in February and I'd see the grass was green and people were out water skiing.
Right.
And it was very warm in the UK in the late 1990s. And I went to high school in Oxford in 1970 and it was much colder then. So it sort of looked to me like, you know, England was warming up. And so I was a true believer, and I even went to the I was coaching soccer here in Longmont, Colorado, in the early 2000s. We were having a terrible drought, and they shut down the soccer fields because of the drought, and they were afraid the grass was going to get damaged. So I went to the city council and pleaded the case that, well, global warming is just going to make this worse, so just let the kids play. And they let me. They opened up a few fields so that we could play. But over the next few years, I observed quite a bit of change and started to become a doubter about the global warming theory, and started looking at research and looking at the data. And I began to understand pretty quickly that the data was being mishandled, and not just slightly mishandled, but extremely mishandled. When I looked at the U.S. temperature data, how it was being manipulated before it was presented to the public. And I started looking at this one thing after another. I realized there was a consistent pattern of data tampering, manipulation, fraud, just outright lying about what was going on with the climate.
Who was doing that, Tony? Sorry to interrupt you. Who was doing that manipulation and tampering?
It was done. It's been done by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA here in the United States. They have similar stuff going on in Australia with the Bureau of Meteorology, too. So and you can definitely see that there's been collusion between agencies like the Climatic Research Unit in England, NOAA, NASA, and BOM. It's pretty clear path of collusion and misbehavior linking those groups together.
And you don't think that they were making honest mistakes, that they were, you know, honest in terms of the way they were analysing that data? You are sure that they could understand the data, but they chose to interpret it in the way they did deliberately, to deliberately create this whole notion that climate change and man-made climate change was real?
Well, I think it's fairly complicated how it happened. I think the way it started, I think it began with NASA's James Hansen, who testified before Congress in 1988 about the greenhouse effect and all the bad things were going to happen. And I think he really believed what he was saying. But unfortunately, the data wasn't bearing out what he wanted it to show. And he actually wrote a paper about that in around 1999, that he was very upset that the U.S. temperature data wasn't cooperating with him. And so he became concerned about it. I think he came to the conclusion that, well, this is going to happen, so tampering with the data is all right because we need to get the message out that we have a problem. And it's going to happen later on anyway. So they start cheating a little bit. It's okay. Nice. And they started doing this more and more, and pretty soon it just became institutionalized, this whole cheating thing with the data. And now I think they're completely lost in it. I think a lot of them probably don't recognize that what they're doing is wrong. I think a lot of them still believe it's probably going to happen sometime in the future. And so the cheating they're doing is okay. So, I can't speak for them. I can't say what their motivations are, but there's no question that it's being done deliberately. It's so blatant what they're up to. And, they turned the U.S. temperature data, which is the best in the world, from a cooling trend into a warming trend. And I'm sure everyone who works on it is well aware of that fact. Whether they believe they're doing the right thing or not is, it's hard for me to guess.
That's very honest of you, Tony. Tony Heller is our guest, folks. If you haven't checked out his website before, realclimatescience.com, do check it out. Tony is on the line from Colorado. I'm fascinated by your soccer interest, Tony. I might get into that with you a little bit later on.
Okay.
But this is far more important, of course. Ironically, I often ask skeptics like yourself, I will always ask, are you connected to anybody? And you honestly say that you're not, and I know you're not. You have to wonder then about the funding of academics. And this is where I'm inclined to give academics a bit of a pass sometimes, because I can understand it. If there's funding coming in for research, and if it's, likely to be increased, if it's likely to be plentiful, if you're going down a certain way, it's easy to see how that can happen, Tony.
Oh, yeah. Well, in order to get funding, everyone in academia knows that in order to get funding in for anything related to climate, and actually a lot of other science topics, if you throw in some global warming propaganda, it greatly increases the possibility of getting additional funding for your research. And I actually made a video about that the other day, about someone who'd written an article which was very much anti-global warming, but he threw in a few global warming words into the article, and I probably slipped it past the peer reviewer by doing that.
Right.
And so the actual content of the paper was very detrimental to global warming, but by throwing in the words they wanted to hear, he got it through peer review and probably got more funding.
Boxing clever, we call that. Yeah, I suppose that's the way it's got to be for people. Yeah, Tony, there's so many questions coming in. You'll see it yourself because you've got a very big Twitter following. If you do the search later on, you'll see the comments coming in. They're flying in. People are talking here about the Maunder minimum. I had Professor Valentina Zharkova on the program a few months back. She gave a fascinating talk to me. I challenged her robustly, but she had the answers that we're heading for a big cooling period in the next few years. So I've got to put that to you. I mean, you can do what you want with that question, but listeners are asking me to put that to you. Ironically, are we in 2030 going to get, for a few years anyway, a bit of a freeze, do we think?
Well, I'm not a forecaster, so I'll just stay away from making my own predictions, but I can tell you some things about the history of it. I mean, it's pretty well established that like the Maunder minimum, during the Little Ice Age, was affiliated with low sunspot counts. And there's been lots of studies over the years. John Herschel, who's an English astronomer in the 18th century, made a correlation between grain prices and sunspot counts. And there's been many other similar studies during the years. where people have made connections between solar activity and the and various aspects of the weather. And also, one of the more interesting examples that I've been looking at recently is that Dr. Walter Orr Roberts, who is the first director of the National Center for Atmospheric Research here in Boulder, Colorado, he was a solar physicist, and he believed very strongly that the weather was controlled by solar activity. And when he was working as a solar physicist in 1951, he noticed a very strong correlation between the solar wind and atmospheric pressure. So there's a long history of scientists who have made connections between solar activity and Earth's climate. And unfortunately, that's all just being ignored now by the mainstream climate community. I think that an understanding of the solar wind, how the solar wind affects climate, is terribly important, and it's completely ignored. There's no money in it, and people who bring it up tend to get criticized and attacked. So it's the orthodox, you know, it's a very similar situation to what we had in the 16th century with geocentrism. You know, there's this orthodoxy, and everything is controlled by carbon dioxide in their belief system, and anyone who challenges that is a heretic and needs to be censored and silenced.
Are we getting close to a time when denying that it's happening is going to be fatal for people in terms of their career prospects, in terms of their present circumstances? Because I'm hearing a lot from the green movement in the UK in the last 2 years, particularly this charge of climate denier, which is thrown at people in a very contemptuous way. And a regular guest on this program is Piers Corbyn, somebody whom I know you'll know all about, Jeremy Corbyn's brother. He's a friend of ours. He comes on the program. He's a highly respected meteorologist, and he's a physicist, and Piers isn't buying it either. He would empathise with you, and we talked about this, and he's worried about this climate denier label and where that might go. What do you think, Tony?
Well, first of all, yeah, I know Piers. He invited me to speak at an event he held in London a few years ago, so I know Piers pretty well. But it's been going on a lot longer than that. I was very good friends with Dr. Bill Gray at Colorado State University, who is considered the world's top tropical meteorologist and the guy who invented hurricane forecasting. And in 1993, when Al Gore became vice president, Gore invited Dr. Gray to a global warming meeting, which Gore was having in Washington. And Bill said, well, I'm happy to attend your meeting, but you need to know that I'm not a big believer in your theories. And immediately after that, Bill got his funding cut off. He'd gotten money out of the NOAA every year since the 1960s, never got another penny out of the government. So, and I've heard the story from a number of other people, too. Dr. Will Happer, who was on Trump's National Security Council, and Trump put him there in order to do a review of the CO2 endangerment finding. He had the same thing. He was head of developing of new technologies at the Department of Energy in 1993, and Gore fired him because he was a climate skeptic.
Wow.
So this has been going on for, going on for almost 30 years.
We've not lost Tony.
Yeah, and I've lost quite a few jobs over this. I started out working under a pen name because I was working for a company, a very green company, and I knew that when they found out, they'd fire me, and they did. When I attended an EU climate meeting in Lisbon in 2011, came back and got walked out the door the next day. And I've lost quite a few other contracts as an engineer over this. So it's probably, even if you're not in the academic community, like I'm in high tech, and high tech is very politically correct, left wing, and when it was found out that I'm a climate, skeptic, that was, that's considered a major black mark against you.
A major black mark. It's got nothing to do with your ability to do your job or how you interact with your colleagues, but it's the wrong opinion to have, Tony. So I mean, this is very strange. Charlie is a girl, is a lady, by the way. She listens to the radio show and follows you. And she's just tweeted this, and she sent me a screenshot. I'm not surprised by this because Twitter has just announced in the last few days that it's changing its terms of service, where it's going to shadow ban people. It's admitted this. Stories all over the mainstream media. Charlie says, I follow Tony, but I've never been able to see his tweets. I can see a goat being burned alive or a pedophile pretending to rape a baby doll, but Tony's tweets are deemed far too sensitive for me. And she's just put a screenshot up of a tweet that you made a couple of hours ago, Tony. And rather than show her the tweet, Twitter has covered it with the caption, "This tweet may include sensitive content." This is disgraceful, Tony.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of that stuff going on. Someone with a lot of money. I'm pretty sure I know who it is, but I'm not gonna say it here. Obviously, he's very concerned about the message, the information which I'm putting out there that goes against their agenda. So that the stuff like that, yeah, Twitter blocks my images. And there's all, if you do a Google search for my name, all kinds of fake websites, people using identity theft, slandering me.
I know.
come up at the top of the search. And someone is paying for that, right? It's really important for someone with a lot of money to make sure that the message which I'm getting out there is seen by as few and believed by as few people as possible.
You are the most genial, warm, down-to-earth, decent bloke that I've watched on. You are. I mean, first of all, your credentials.
Thanks, Richard.
No, you are, Tony. Your credentials are unimpeachable. They are. I shouldn't maybe say that, but I am saying it. They are. You're a gentleman. You're very softly spoken. You're analysing data that's in the public domain for everybody to see, and you are drawing a different conclusion than others. And the fact that you might lose work or have to tiptoe around in your present job or be banned by Twitter, it's very, very sinister, Tony. It really is. Kelly is listening to this in Ireland with great interest as well. Huge interest in you coming on today. By the way, when I first came across you and I was trying to reach you, obviously I did the Google search just to see what people were saying about you, because I know what's going to happen when I go looking for somebody like you. And you're right, lots of websites declaring you to be a kook or a crank or a shill, lots of fake stuff. But this is Google. It's the only game in town. This is what Google does, you know.
Yeah.
And I eventually find your website. I look at this stuff. To be honest, Piers had mentioned you before, Piers. And I'm like, this guy's a decent guy. He's an intelligent guy. He's just got something to say. And yet they're trying to shut you down. I don't want to. This is why this program exists. My listeners are intelligent enough to make up their own minds. They hear you and they make their own minds up as to whether you're legitimate or not. That's the way it goes. Tony Heller is our guest this afternoon, live from Colorado, realclimatescience.com. And it is a valuable website. And he is a really interesting guy. And if you can send a couple of bucks every now and then to Tony, that's how you keep these journalists going, because he is a journalist as much as he is working in high tech now. Why, Tony, then? Do you know, one of the most common questions I was asked to put to you today is, why have they weaponized or demonized CO2? What's going on? Is there some agenda behind this that's even beyond most people's imagination? If they know it's nonsense, why are they pushing it?
Well, CO2 represents energy, right? The vast majority of the world's energy supply is generated from burning coal and oil and natural gas. So CO2 is directly tied into that. So if you can control CO2 emissions, limit CO2 emissions, you control the energy supply. And you know, I think it's been pretty well established that Russia has been funding anti-fracking groups. And the reason for doing that is obvious, because Russia wants to be, they see low prices of natural gas as being a threat to them, because so much of their economy is dependent on it. So by funding these anti-fracking groups in the West, they shut down natural gas production in Europe and the United States, and thus make Europe dependent on Russian natural gas, which is exactly what's going on in Germany. And they have all these green energy laws, and they're not using German coal, and instead they're buying Russian natural gas. So it's been very effective for them.
Tony, but just a quick question on that. Sorry to interrupt you there. Just a quick question on that. I would know some environmentally conscious anti-fracking groups. And I'm pretty sure. Now, listen, I know you are right, by the way. I know the Russians are and have funded anti-fracking groups. But a lot of environmentalists, they genuinely believe that fracking is devastating for the water supply in areas. It's devastating for the land. And it, you know, it's been proven to cause earthquakes. So some of our listeners might say, well, there's some good reasons to be opposed to fracking. What would you say to that?
Well, I live here in northern Colorado, which is, there's fracking wells everywhere out here. Like there's parts, you can go driving around out here and you'll see a fracking well every quarter mile. So they're all over here. I haven't seen any indication that people's health are suffering from it. And this is a very environmentally conscious community. And I'm a lifelong environmentalist myself. I fought very hard for the Clean Air and Water Act. I testified at a congressional hearing when I was 14 years old in support of wilderness. I ride my bicycle everywhere. I'm involved in a lot of environmental things now. So I'm as strong an environmentalist and well-credentialed as there is.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, to me, having low energy prices and clean energy like natural gas is incredibly beneficial to the environment. If you look back at what London was like before they had petroleum, you know, the streetlights in London were burning whale oil.
Yeah, they were, yeah, yeah.
So the petroleum saved the whales, literally saved the whales. And people burned, you know, before we had coal and natural gas, and people burned wood or dung. And that's a huge problem still in the developing world, where people don't have access to modern electricity facilities or natural gas. You know, they burn dung to cook their food, and they have a very high mortality rate, you know, yeah, sickness and mortality rate as a result of that. These people would be much better off, their environment would be much cleaner, if they had access to coal-fired electricity or natural gas-fired electricity or natural gas stoves to do their cooking in.
I think we'd probably disagree on fracking. I don't declare myself to be an expert on anything. I worry about the earthquakes. We've had a lot of them here in the Northwest when they've been testing the stuff. And I know in Oklahoma, which is not too far, well, it's far enough away from you, I suppose, they had regular earthquakes there as well. And I'm not convinced that it doesn't render the land ultimately unusable. But anyway, look, that's just my opinion. And I, as I said, nobody made me God. I wouldn't be in favour of fracking, but that's neither here nor there. I'm very interested in what you're saying about taking control of energy and getting rid of, you know, getting rid of carbon based fuels, because while they're dirty, I mean, there's no doubt they're dirty. But as you know, Tony, having been to this country many times, we're sitting on, I don't know the exact figure, but we're sitting on centuries worth of coal here. And it's here. It's usable. It could be used to fire our generators. It would certainly bring about a lot more employment in this country. And while the smoke is not the most pleasant thing in the world, it's not going to change the bloody climate, is it? I'd be in favour of opening those coal mines again, Tony. But that's just me. I'm sure you'll disagree with that.
Well, the coal mines, the thing about coal is the technology has vastly improved over the last 40 years. There's a coal-fired power plant up north of here, north of Fort Collins, Colorado, which puts out essentially no visible emissions at all.
Wow.
What they do now is they grind the coal up into a very fine powder, inject it into an extremely high chamber where they burn it, and it burns almost instantaneously and creates very little particulates. So yeah, back in the 60s and 70s, coal burning power plants were very dirty, but modern technology prevents that. So you don't need to have the pollution from coal anymore. And I think coal is a tremendously valuable resource. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, actually, she started using the global warming thing as a tool against the coal miners at one point. And she later repented and realized that the whole global warming thing was a joke. But she was one of the original politicians pushing global warming, and it was mainly as to create political leverage against the coal miners who were striking.
What are you going to do, Tony? Somebody like yourself. By the way, folks, realclimatescience.com. Tony Heller, academic, teacher, scientist. knows his way around big tech as well. Very interesting man, critical thinker, and has been analysing this for many, many, many years, and gives his honest opinion and his honest assessment as to why he doesn't believe that man-made CO2 is contributing to catastrophic climate change. I'm glad that Tony's on the programme, live from Colorado. What are you going to do, guys like you and Piers Corbyn? They're trying to silence you. They're doing everything they can to do it. YouTube, Google just admitted in the last couple of weeks that it now is looking at basically delisting channels that aren't commercially viable. I mean, come on, Tony, you don't have to be Lieutenant Columbo to know that the channels that they won't find commercially viable are channels run by academics like yourself. What are we going to do in order... Because it seems... I mean, I agree with you when you talked about the energy aspect to this whole hoax, because I believe it to be a hoax. But I also think it goes into another kind of a sinister area as well, where a lot of it is about controlling people and, you know, boxing people into this kind of horrible dystopian future where everything we eat, where everywhere we go, where we travel is all monitored and watched, you know, on the basis that it's to improve the chances of the planet surviving in the future. I think it's really, really sinister, I think. Do you think I'm crazy when I say that, or do you see some aspect of what I've just said being true?
Well, I think what we have going on in the West right now is very similar to what went on in the Soviet Union. The government has an agenda, and they've taken control of the press, and they think they can control the message by doing that. But if you look at someone like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was a victim, you know, who was a target of their censorship in the Soviet Union, he ended up the censorship they did against him greatly increased people's awareness of him. And so it doesn't really work. You can't really silence the truth. You know, they'll desperately try, but it's not going to work one way or another. The truth is going to get out there. And when they do things, you know, like when they banned me on Twitter a few weeks ago for a while, I ended up getting a huge increase in my following. You know, that sort of thing is... When people see that authority is banning someone and trying to keep them from hearing from them, it gets people interested. Well, this person must have some sort of interesting message.
It certainly piques your curiosity. You're absolutely right, right, Tony. I have no doubt about it. But I hope you're right when you say that. Our listeners who don't know who Solzhenitsyn is, by the way, check him out. We wouldn't know about the gulags if it wasn't for him. Check him out. He's a very, very interesting man historically. Because what they want to do, Tony, is... You see, I always look at the solutions offered or proffered. So they say, if we don't change in the next few years, we're finished. So they start saying things like, no new cars produced after 2030. The elimination of diesel cars. The imposition of diets on people. You know, now they're talking about voluntary. They're saying that people need to not eat so much meat and all that. But they're admitting that in the near future, they might have to impose that on people. It is Orwellian, isn't it, Tony? That's where I get scared and I think, well, maybe there's, you know, a little bit more to this than just meets the eye, you know? And, you know, often we scoff at conspiracy theories and then later on we find out that, well, we weren't too far from the truth there, because the solutions being offered, Tony, they're horrific, right?
Yeah, they're not... First of all, they don't solve anything.
No.
You know, the claims... You know, if you look at who's actually producing the carbon dioxide, it's Asia. The output, CO2 output from Asia is vastly dominates the world. They're building hundreds of new coal-fired power plants, and nothing, you know, the United States could literally drop off the face of the earth and would have almost no impact on CO2 emissions, because right now it's China and India and other Asian countries are dominating the growth of and usage of carbon dioxide. So I know it's very difficult for Westerners who are used to believing they control the world,
yeah,
to accept the fact that they don't anymore. But the fact is there's nothing the UK could do or the United States or the EU which would actually have a significant impact on reducing carbon dioxide emissions.
And is it true, Tony, sorry to interrupt you, is it true that termites, I heard Piers say this recently, I didn't get a chance to double check it, he might have said it to me actually on a radio program, do termites produce more CO2 than man?
Well, yeah, I think that that's kind of a difficult question. You know, if they do, you know, the CO2 which they'd be producing would just be sort of net zero, probably, because they're producing, they eat living things, and then they produce the emit the CO2, and then that CO2 goes back into living things. The concern with what humans are doing is that we're taking coal and things like coal beds, which formed hundreds of millions of years ago, and which absorbed carbon dioxide, which was present in the atmosphere hundreds of millions of years ago, and now we're re-releasing that back into the atmosphere. And so that's believed to be the reason why carbon dioxide levels have gone up from 300 parts per million up to 400 parts per million over the past century. So I don't necessarily buy the volcano or termite arguments. I pretty much accept the idea that humans burning coal and have increased carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. I just don't see any reason to be concerned about it. In fact, it's probably a good thing, because it's very well established that plants grow faster at higher CO2 levels, and with the world's population increasing, you know, the fact that plants are growing faster and are more drought resistant as a result of CO2 is a very good thing.
Really good thing. Let me ask you this, bearing in mind the program that you're on, and this, it really is an open forum, this, we talk to everybody, academics, politicians, but also, you know, people that would be described as conspiracy theorists, but they're always challenged. There are a lot of my listeners who believe that weather manipulation is a real thing. In fact, Piers Corbyn is somebody who's convinced that it happens, or it has been trialed, or it happens. I wonder about some of these, you know, storms that we have or that we hear about. Does it ever occur to you, or is it just something you don't touch, that maybe some of this stuff is artificial, some of the weather events?
Well, a lot of what I do is historical research about weather. That's probably the main thing I do, in fact. So I have a pretty extensive knowledge of past weather events, and I don't see any reason to believe that recent weather events have been any more extreme than what's occurred many times in the past. And in fact, I think you could actually make a case that we've been experiencing a spell of relatively mild weather compared to a lot of periods in history. So for me, that question isn't even a valid question.
Fair enough.
I don't see that there's been any change in the weather to speak of.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Speaking of mild weather, being based, I spent some years in Spain, back here in the UK for a few years, and the winters here, and they historically are pretty harsh in the northwest, in Greater Manchester, Salford, Bolton, Liverpool. But the winters have been very mild, Tony. It definitely correlates with what you just said there. It has been very mild in the last few years. But of course, that's manna from heaven to the climate evangelicals, I should say, because they love that, don't they? They put that down to the fact that we're warming.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that Western Europe has warmed significantly over the last 40 years. I've done a fair amount of research on that. On the other hand, the United States has not. Large portions of the United States have gotten much cooler, and so the idea of calling it global warming, you know, doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. And you can also look. I've looked at extensively at the Australian records, and you can see that Australia was extremely hot in the late 19th century. January of 1896, they had just unbelievably hot temperatures in southeastern Australia. So what's going on in, you know, in England and France and Germany isn't necessarily representative of what's going on in the rest of the world. And actually, interestingly, the eastern Arctic, like Iceland and Greenland, they have followed the U.S. pattern much more closely. Iceland was very warm in the 1940s, cooled down a lot into the 1970s, and then has warmed up again some towards the year 2000, and appears like they may be cooling again now. So what you're experiencing there in England is not necessarily representative of what's going on in the whole world. And it undoubtedly has some more to do with ocean circulation patterns than with anything related to carbon dioxide.
Certainly not CO2. I was very disappointed last week to read about the water levels dropping in Victoria Falls. And I'll tell you why I was disappointed, Tony. Because I've been a journalist for many years.
Yeah.
And I produced talk radio commercially and briefly nationally. And I teach radio. I still do. I haven't done it for a while. And I was disgusted to see national news television channels getting away with pointing to a lower level of water in Zambia, at Victoria Falls, the Zambezi, and saying, well, this is absolute proof that these droughts, terrible, it's woeful. And I only needed myself to go to Wikipedia. That's all I had to do, Tony.
Yeah.
To figure out that, well, no, at various periods, the 60s, 70s, 80s, mid-90s, mid-2000s, Victoria Falls water dropped off quite significantly, and then a couple of years later, loads of rains, and it came right back up. That's not, we can't put that down to lazy journalism. That's an agenda, that. I mean, if I can find it out in 3 minutes, and I don't have a producer, I don't have an editor or a researcher, it's pretty abysmal, isn't it, that the media will just push that out there and not look, not find out.
Yeah, it's very easy to do this kind of research. I've got an article I'm looking at right now, February 1st, 1958, from the Honolulu Advertiser. Victoria Falls runs dry.
Wow.
Victoria Falls recently fell away to a trickle, reaching the lowest level in living memory. So this happens. It's happened many times in the past. And like I said, it's very easy these days with these newspaper archives. I mean, like, you can go to newspapers.com, get a subscription there, type in Victoria Falls runs dry, and this will come up right away. It's literally 30 seconds worth of research is all that's required to debunk most of this stuff.
Well, it's important that guys like you are doing that. I'll tell you why, Tony, because Google exists to erase history. Now, there's a conspiracy theory for you right there, right? But it does do. Google is disappearing stuff. I don't sound like an academic here. I don't sound like a journalist. Google is absolutely erasing stuff from history, isn't it? And it won't be long before you go looking for Victoria Falls water level history, Tony, and you don't get very much back. It won't be long.
Well, I don't rely on Google. I rely on like newspapers.com. The New York Times has an excellent archive of their papers. The Australian government has a really good archive of Australian newspapers, Trove. It's called Trove. So there's lots of, you know, there's a lot of old newspaper articles which are very easy to find. So I'm not worried about losing that. Actually, Google News used to have a really good archive search tool, but they got rid of it about 5 years ago, interestingly enough. And they said it was just broken and they were going to fix it, but it became obvious after a few months that it was an intentional breakage and that they had no intention of fixing it.
Wow.
Because they didn't want people to be able to go back and find these old articles.
Of course not.
But, you know, this is exactly what Orwell wrote about in the novel 1984, The Ministry of Truth, whose job was to rewrite history. And in order to... Orwell said, he who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past. And that's exactly what they're doing.
That's what they're doing. John is in Salford, and he says, June 1876, on the way to their historic encounter with Sitting Bull in Montana, the cavalry was surprised to find themselves in a blizzard, in a snow blizzard. And the Battle of Little Bighorn was a few days later, and of course, that was fought on a scorching hot Sunday. Weather, says John, anomalous weather patterns have always been the way throughout history. Do you know what, Tony, next time I'm watching Sky News or the BBC and some climate evangelical from Extinction Rebellion is on there, I'm going to cry with depression that you're not on the programme, you know, that you're not on there to at least say, well, listen, hang on a second, there is another way. I really do mean that. RealClimateScience.com. Tony, tell me you are a Manchester United supporter, even though you lived in Bristol for a while, you were down Oxford way. Tell me you're a United fan, Tony.
I can't tell you. In fact, I'm actually a city.
Are you a city fan? Yeah. Tell the truth now. When did that happen? When did you become a City fan?
I've been a City fan for a really long time, actually.
Well, then I sincerely congratulate you, because we've had it all our own way for 25 years. And for the Blue Noses, it must be great times. You didn't beat us in the Derby on Sunday, but I don't think it changed the status of both sides. City are still way, way ahead of where United are at the moment. But a City fan, Tony. And so you get the games on NBC, no, in the States. Is that how you watch the games?
No, actually, I don't have a television. So what I do is I just watch. Google usually has YouTube highlights. So what I tend to do is just watch like the 10 minutes of highlights after the game than actually watching the game. Like you said, I'm really busy these days.
Of course, so. You're up to your eyes with the job. And tell me this before we run out of time. You're up to your eyes on realclimatescience.com and the YouTube channel. And you've coached the game yourself, which I'm fascinated by, because there's a real renaissance now in your country, isn't there, in the last few years. Major League Soccer is doing really well. Is the coaching something? I mean, I know you've just said you're very, very busy. So it sounds like you don't coach anymore. Would you like to coach again?
I would, but I just don't have time anymore. Like I said, I went to high school in England, in Oxford in 1970, came back and stuck with it. I played soccer ever since. I was on the Arizona State University soccer team in 1974. Mm. And so I coached and played for many decades. I haven't played for a few years, mostly because I'm too busy. I'd love to go back. I always keep thinking I'm going to go back out there and play. But for some reason, it's strange. I never see pickup games anymore in Boulder. For a long time, I used to be able to always find a pickup match to go out and play, and I can't ever find them anymore. So I'm a little disappointed. If I saw one, I would probably just throw my boots on and go out and play. But
join in. But this is the advent of tablets and smartphones and all this nonsense. People are consumed by that. And what position did you play? I was a centre half. I'm 6 foot six, you see. I was a big centre half.
Yeah.
What about yourself?
I was a striker.
We'd have knocked heads then, me and you. We'd have knocked heads, yeah, if we'd have played.
Well, it sounds like since 6 foot six, it's probably better that I didn't knock.
You'd have gone around me. You'd have gone around me, Tony. Yeah, no doubt. Listen, we're sadly just about out of time. Thanks for giving us the time. I really appreciate that. Kind of short notice as well. But because the COP25 thing is going on, I'm really glad that we got you on. Continued success to you in getting around the censors on Twitter and on Google. Do find Tony on YouTube. It's very easy to find him. I'll tweet a link out. You can find him on Twitter. He's @Tony_Heller. @Tony_Heller. And the website is realclimatescience.com. I hope we'll speak again in the future, Tony. Thanks so much for your time today. It was an education.
Okay, thank you, Richie. It was good being on.
Real pleasure. Thanks, Tony. That was Tony Heller live on the line to us there from his home in Colorado, realclimatescience.com. And there is a treasure trove there of articles and graphs and charts, historic information about the whole notion of climate change. And it's very, very good. So I do recommend that you check it out. That's about it for today's programme. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9:30. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, with the newspaper review. Sadly, the newspapers, of course, blanket coverage of the forthcoming election, which is, of course, on Thursday. So there might be a bit of election stuff around, but we'll try and keep it entertaining. That's tomorrow at 9:30. It's a nonsensical pile of claptrap. It's the paper review on YouTube. And I'll be back with you tomorrow at 5. And Ray McGovern will be one of my guests tomorrow. And boy, does he have some really interesting information about Seth Rich. Ray McGovern. Don't want to miss that tomorrow on your Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. My website, triggerwarning.tv, and all the usual channels as well. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Thanks again to Tony Heller. What a top man for coming on the programme. We'll go out with Marvin Gaye and say adieu. Farewell. Until tomorrow. Alrighty. This is cool. See you tomorrow. Bye.